Talo Falava, you're listening to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Kuroi Hawkins. Coming up...
People are actually quite nervous and scared. Nobody wants to leave their homes.
A health disaster looms as Timor-Leste is hit by devastating flooding.
Saying that they will not take on vaccines, that also sends messages to the wider population on their stand.
Vaccine hesitancy complicates PNG's COVID crisis. Plus, brighter prospects for the Marshalls community in Arkansas and history made as a Pacifica District Court judge is appointed in New Zealand. Timor-Leste has been hit by deadly flooding and landslides amid the threats of a new COVID-19 outbreak. According to local authorities, six children are among dozens who lost their lives during the Easter weekend disaster, which also destroyed homes, bridges and roads, inundating the capital, Dili. Amid all of this, the country announced its first COVID-related death on Monday, a 44-year-old woman who'd been undergoing treatment for the infection. Her death was announced on the same day Timor-Leste also received its first batch of COVID-19 vaccines. Christine Ravoy has more.
Timor-Leste, formerly East Timor, is a Southeast Asian nation with a population of around 1.3 million people. It has close ties with its Pacific neighbours and has Polynesian and Melanesian enclaves on the eastern and western parts of the island. Last weekend, these communities were hit with heavy rain brought on by a cyclone in nearby Indonesia. Last month, Dili's population of 220,000 was ordered into lockdown, along with the cities of Baucau and Vikeke, following a surge in community transmission of the coronavirus. Security expert Jose Souza Santos is from Timor-Leste and is the policy fellow at the Australia Pacific Security College. He says it's been a tough week.
We come from the eastern tip of Timor, which is Polynesian Melanesian. I still have a number of nephews which had been evacuated to Hera, which is just outside of Dili. Unfortunately, we don't know what has actually happened to them, and people are actually quite nervous and scared. Nobody wants to leave their homes, mainly because of fear of infection from COVID, but also I think this has been quite a traumatizing event.
Timor-Leste now has 765 COVID cases, with 472 active cases isolated in hospitals. Souza Santos says the government is trying to separate the thousands of displaced residents at evacuation centres in a bid to contain the virus.
The government utilised and employed a very strict regimen of contact tracing and was able to contain the virus to those three major cities. With the floods, the lockdowns became ineffectual as the law enforcement and other agencies which were tasked to maintain these lockdowns were more focused on the emergency response to the floods.
On Wednesday, Timor-Leste launched its vaccination program following the arrival of 24,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine through the COVAX initiative. UNICEF's representative in Dili, Bilal Darani, says frontline workers and those vulnerable will get the first jab.
The plan is to have, at least in the first half of the year, 100,800 vaccines to be delivered to Timor-Leste. So that resulted in slightly lower doses that we received in the first batch, but we are very hopeful that we'll receive the remaining at the middle of the year and then the remaining 20% in the rest of the year.
Mr. Darani says the challenge now for the government is to continue to ensure and encourage its people to get vaccinated.
There were a lot of questions around, you know, whether the vaccines are effective, what are the side effects, a lot of doubts about it. So we used all the scientific data to communicate that message. The government with the development partners have been running a campaign about the vaccines. We've produced a lot of materials and brochures. We're using TV, we're using radio.
Meanwhile, the government is seeking international help following the catastrophic floods that have killed dozens and left thousands of Timorese homeless. New Zealand stands ready to consider any requests for assistance from Timor-Leste or Indonesia. Assistant Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade, Aupito Williams-Seo, says New Zealand has made funding available through its embassy in Dili to support initial response to the flooding. Aupito, who is also Minister for Pacific Peoples, says Foreign Minister Nanaia Mahuta is coordinating New Zealand's efforts to ensure the support for Timor-Leste.
As a Pacific nation, we're very, very comfortable that our role here, from the lens of we're whanaungatanga, that we will do all that we can. But obviously it's far better when we're collaborating with other like-minded partners like Australia and others.
Australia's government says it's particularly concerned about the risk of waterborne diseases, as well as shortages of clean water and food in Timor-Leste, which sits to Australia's north. Foreign Minister Marie Spain says Australia also stands ready to provide more assistance to its neighbour. In Timor-Leste, government officials and NGOs are scrambling to work out the full extent of the damage, where raging waters and mudslides have also swept away houses, destroyed roads and carried away bridges. How near Narang, Christine Ravoy.
The need for vaccine awareness is greater than ever in Papua New Guinea as it struggles with COVID-19, according to a health specialist there. PNG's worrying surge of the coronavirus has seen the number of confirmed cases more than quadrupled in the past month alone to about 8,000. As health authorities try and stem the rate of infection around the country, the rollout of a first batch of 8,000 AstraZeneca vaccines has begun slowly. The World Bank's senior health specialist in PNG, Dr. Edith Karako, spoke to me about the country's health crisis.
So through their domestic supply, we've had the Australians give 8,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine last week. So launched by the Prime Minister, James Marape, receiving the vaccine last week, and of course rolled out with priority groups, including health. First and foremost, of course, the health workers in Port Moresby particularly.
There's been a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of misinformation driving what seems to be a lot of hesitancy that we're hearing in terms of people willing to come forward for the vaccine.
There's a lot of uncertainty around this adult vaccination program. We know in Papua New Guinea, we've always had child vaccination or immunization programs, which is really part and parcel of our way of life now. You know, it's normal to have a mother take their child for vaccination. But in this event, in this particular situation, we're now having adult vaccination. And of course, it's been quite challenging in terms of, you know, now that we have a priority group of health workers, of course, this group of health workers are not well knowledgeable about this new vaccine, and this has also brought a lot of issues surrounding vaccine hesitancy among health workers.
If the health workers are raising doubts, that kind of shoots you in the foot going forward for a wider vaccination drive if you get through them.
That's correct. You know, the health professionals in our country are, you know, seen as very credible health information give us, if to say, and you know, when they're coming out, particularly in media, and this is through the Nursing Council, saying that they will not take on vaccines, that also sends messages to the wider population on their stand on whether to take vaccines or not. So it's a huge issue, and it's of course a good communications strategy perhaps should be put forward in terms of how to address this so that we can be able to utilize the gift of the 8,000 doses while we wait for the country's supply.
And what are the main concerns the Nurses Council is raising?
A lot want to know about side effects of it, and understandably so. Yes, we can say that the country didn't go out in a big way in terms of awareness of vaccines. So I think the issues raised are good issues, particularly for the wider community in understanding what these vaccines are before they can receive. I am aware that the issues have been addressed on since them raising it last week. It's currently been addressed in terms of awareness going out to the nurses. So it's continuing. There are health workers coming to get the vaccines, yes. The only issue is the uptake has been very low since the program rolled out since last week.
8,000 vaccines doesn't sound like a lot for a country of 8 million plus people.
No, it doesn't. You could see the 8,000 doses as a dry run for the bigger immunization program. In doing that, of course, there are issues not just in terms of giving the vaccines, but the logistics around and planning around how that's going to roll out, not just for Port Moresby, but when it comes to the wider country.
And what is in the pipeline in terms of vaccine supply for Papua New Guinea?
So, yes, we do have the COVAX facility, of which the government has ordered its supplies through, and that we hope to have in the vicinity of 288,000 doses land, hopefully in May. following through with the rest to come not shortly after that. A lot of other countries have tried to donate, but that's still yet to be confirmed in terms of the doses that are to be donated, if any.
That was the World Bank's senior health specialist in PNG, Dr. Edith Kariko, and you can hear more from her in the VOSA podcast. Over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, RNZ Pacific has regularly touched base with one of the more isolated islander communities on the United States mainland. About 15,000 people with a Marshall Islands heritage live in northwest Arkansas, where many of them work in meat plants. It has suffered tremendously from COVID-19, with dozens of deaths and thousands of people becoming infected. Dr. Sheldon Ricklin grew up in the Marshalls and got his medical training in Hawaii. These days, he's an associate professor at the University of Arkansas's medical campus in Fayetteville in northwest Arkansas. Don Wiseman asked him how it is now in the Marshallese community 13 months after the pandemic arrived.
Well, after 13 months, we're faring much better than we were back in summer of 2020. So it's definitely much better now. You know, things are looking up for us. The numbers that we've had last year have definitely improved for the better.
Yes. What are those numbers? What are the most recent numbers?
I left my notes in the office, but as of Monday, we were told that there were only 4 active Marshallese cases in the community, which surprisingly went up from the weeks before where it was 0 active cases for several days or a week or so.
Overall, in this small community, I think less than 15,000, how many people have been infected?
From what I recall, it was 2,000 plus, close to 3, were the total number of cases that were positive with COVID-19 over the course of the last several months.
So 20% of the population, roughly.
Around there, yes. At one point, I think, especially in northwest Arkansas region, you know, we had accounted for about 19% of the cases. And, you know, I think estimates are that we constitute about 2.4% of the population here. So these numbers are much better than that from where we were, you know, last summer.
What have you done that has helped to turn these numbers around?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's multiple things that happened over the course of the last several months. One of them being that, you know, we organized ourselves rather quickly, you know, in terms of the community leadership and community members, and organized ourselves with this Marshallese COVID-19 task force, which, you know, has representation from different Marshallese organizations, including the Marshall Islands Council General's office, who basically leads the COVID-19 task force, and some of the major medical centers here, as well as the community clinic that many of our citizens go and take health care, plus many of the nonprofit organizations that are run by the Marshallese folks. And working together with them and along with the Northwest Arkansas Council and come up with different ways in addressing the problems and basically making sure that people were listening to the right messages, that the messages were culturally and linguistically appropriate for us. We put names and faces to the people who were talking about the disease and trying to educate people. So it was mostly Marshallese folks talking about it, whether it was through, you know, billboards or flyers or Facebook live shows or radio programs. We even took part in being some of the contact tracers and health navigators that was run by, you know, led by UAMS, or University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. And, you know, it was basically working together with these folks and our healthcare system folks to make sure that whatever issues that arose, that we addressed them, you know, rather quickly and, you know, adjust accordingly to make sure that the messages got across.
All right. We're hearing a lot in this country about the variants that are appearing in a number of places around the world. Is that a concern there in Arkansas?
Yes, it is. You know, and, you know, our governor still has his weekly radio, weekly public outreach or sessions that he talks to the media about these things. And, you know, just recently he took down the mask mandate as of last month. But, you know, he was still, you know, warning and at least talking about it, including our Secretary of Health, about the variants that are. We know that there's maybe a few here in Arkansas, but definitely around the states that's around Arkansas, there has been, you know, more numbers, and there's increasing number of variants that, you know, we're all definitely worried about, especially with this transmissibility among different people.
That was Dr. Sheldon Ricklin from the Marshalls community in Arkansas. The New Zealand city of Lower Hutt has become the first outside Auckland with a Pacifica resident district court judge. The selection of a Samoan New Zealander is being hailed as the vanguard of diversity and representation, the embodiment of the Te Ao Marama, a reflection of the judicial needs of a multicultural Aotearoa. Judge Mike Mika himself described his porphyry at Waifetu Marae in simpler terms, calling it a homecoming. Dominic Godfrey was there.
Michael Mika grew up in Kairangi, the Hutt Valley, with mum and dad, Fou and Salafai, the Methodist Whaifiao, or Reverend, two younger brothers and extended Ainga. He went to school and played rugby there before being lured to Dunedin to study law. He was admitted to the bar in 1996. A quarter of a century on, and with many years practising law in Invercargill under his belt, he's home to the Hutt as a judge. Chief District Court Judge Hemi Taumonu says Judge Mika is an exciting appointment which sends a strong, positive message to the community.
That the District Court kaupapa of Te Ao Marama and the new model, the new way of doing business, is a real thing, with a resident judge being appointed for the first time to the Hutt Valley and that judge being of Samoan descent.
For Mike Mika, Samoa remains central to identity. Covered in lei and bright red ulafala necklaces, he speaks Samoan and is versed in the cultural nuances of Fa Samoa. He's also played rugby for Otago and the Highlanders in a career that took him to Wales in 1995 for Manu Samoa, where they defeated the hosts in the Rugby World Cup. The Minister for Courts and for Pacific Peoples, Aupito William Sio, says he's come home to a community that's very proud of him.
I'm particularly proud because he's bilingual, strong bilingual, and so he'll bring a cultural lens. It's a hard task being a judge, and so I think that cultural lens that he brings to the role is going to help him dispense with some complex and challenging issues that will come to his court.
One who knows those challenges is Auckland's Judge Ida Malosi, New Zealand's first woman Pasifika judge, who says Judge Mika is the right person for the big task ahead of him. She says it's been 19 years since the first and last Pasifika male appointment, so Judge Mika has been a long time coming.
I might say it was worth the wait because he's such an outstanding man, but of course so many lost opportunities along the way. But we're here, and the Chief Judge has talked about Te Ao Marama, and for our Pasifika people, for me it feels like this is the new light.
Judge Mika knows where he'll be directing that light.
My passion is, and I suppose I have a real heart for our young people, and that's where I want to be working, in the district court realm. That's where I think our judiciary has been and will continue to make changes, and it's working with our youth.
He says his initial focus will be on learning the ropes, but making sure everyone has a fair crack is a long-term priority. He says the community needs to feel that institutions do represent them.
There hasn't been a Pasifika judge here in Kairangi, and I suppose it's good for people to see people that look like them.
The Police Commissioner, Andrew Costa, agrees. He says the judiciary plays a significant part in the response to issues in the community, so it's important that it reflects them.
Understanding of the issues that lead to offending are absolutely key in responding appropriately to it, and we see where we have diverse representation, whether it's in policing, in the judiciary or in other parts, that the understanding is enhanced and then we can respond in the right way. So it's really positive.
Michael Mika was sworn in as a judge on March the 8th. Ko Dominic Godfrey, DNA.
And that's Dateline from RNZ Pacific. You can download us free to your mobile on any podcast platform. And if you are using Apple, leave us a rating so others can also find us. Tō whā soifua.